most things happen in New York. Sun rises first here. We do the really tough stuff here and ultimately set the tone for the nation.
Hi there, it's WAMC News Director Ian Pickus. And on this episode of the WAMC News Podcast, an exit interview with New York State's Department of Environmental Conservation Commissioner. Well, DEC Commissioner Basil Sagos is stepping down. After more than 8 years in the role under two governors, Sagos will leave Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul's administration this spring as the state's longest-serving DEC commissioner. While in Governor Andrew Cuomo's cabinet, Sagos, in November 2018, announced plans to leave, but changed his mind the following February. As he prepares to step down again, Sagos sat down with my colleague, Lucas Willard.
The work is incredible. It really is an incredible position, DEC commissioner. And I honor it. I try to honor it every day when I come in because the stakes are so high. People expect a lot out of us in New York. People look at us from beyond New York. What are we doing as a state to protect the environment, to advance new policies? So I take that really seriously, and I've been lucky, in particular the last few years, to have a governor that has really backed me up, backed up this agency, and allowed us to do really big things. So, you know, when I think about what kept me coming back to this job, it was the work. It was the stuff that we had not yet done that was extraordinarily promising in some ways. And of course, obviously having the resources to do it, but in some ways it comes down to the people you work with. And I think, you know, 2015, I inherit the agency, right? Come in, basically inherit a team. And over that time have basically built the team, 140 plus appointees now within the agency. And I think all but two of them are mine, which is kind of crazy to think about. I've been so lucky to build an amazing team that I want to come back and work with them. And that I think has driven me forward just constantly over time.
So what led you to the decision to say, you know, I'm ready to take a step back?
Well, listen, it's a range of factors. I mean, 8.5 years is a long time in a job like this. I have big interests. Not that this isn't a huge job, it is, but I have interest beyond this job. I've been doing a lot on international front in the last couple of years. I've drawn to things beyond just the environmental world. That is my focus. That's my expertise. That's what I will always be doing. But I think that's just for starters. What's sort of, you know, reminded me that I need to start challenging myself a little bit more in my career. And the other thing is, I think every institution needs change sometimes. You know, I am not jaded. I'm not tired. We don't have a negativity within the office that's kind of driven me out. I truly am surrounded by really amazing, positive people. So it isn't that, but I know that the institution itself needs to change. It just, all of them do. Every single institution needs to bring somebody in every few years at the top to just create new energy, new ideas. And I feel like I've done what I wanted to do, build it, rebuild it in some ways, add lots of new staff and resources, done some really extraordinary things on the outside. I think just the work we've done with the legislature on keeping New York in the lead on so many environmental issues, that I knew I could step away. And there's always going to be these just like 15 things on the table that I wish if I just had one more month, I could just do these 15 more things. But it really is, you know, I think I just know it's time. And I've made the right choice here.
Now you are sticking around through the budget season.
Yes.
Is there any particular environmental legislation that's on the table right now that you really want to get out the door and over the hurdle through the legislature to the governor before you take a step back in May?
Yeah, well, listen, I mean, we have, in a very challenging budget year, we actually have a very good budget, DEC does. So I want to make sure that we have that, that our staffing numbers are the same, that we have the investments the governor wants to make on the Environmental Protection Fund, $400 million, clean water, $500 million over 2 years. You know, the work we do on Brownfield Superfund, all of that relies on good staffing. So, I mean, those are the things I absolutely want to secure. The legislature is going to work on a number of big issues over the next several months, probably beyond my tenure, into the legislative session, which ends in June. So there'll be some things that come out, I think, during the next, you know, when the one houses drop, probably, what, next week, next couple of weeks. We'll make some assessments at that point as to what we need to do to triangulate and advance the Gov's proposals. But, you know, we have really, really great ideas in the works right now. The governor's tree proposal, increasing the tree cover in New York State by 2033, 25 million trees, you know, big down payment on cleaning our air and greening our streets. So that's certainly there. And resiliency is a huge focus right now, climate resiliency. That is in some ways part of the budget, but it's really a state of the state initiative. We want to make sure we're putting money into keeping the state on a proactive footing when it comes to climate change and severe weather. And I think that's something I want to solidify before I leave.
Do you think that the state is still on track to meet its climate goals, but also there are some big ticket items of legislation that are a part of that, like the HEAT Act, mm-hmm. that still faces some opposition in the legislature? There is a pushback of the electrifying of school buses. Mm-hmm. Do you think that there are significant hurdles in the legislature to getting some major legislation passed to keep New York on track?
Mm. Listen, I think there are significant hurdles worldwide on this issue. I mean, New York is not different. We are seeing the concerns about affordability, the concerns about technology, the marketplace. COVID really took a chunk out of the progress we were making. The supply chain issues that still linger, inflation. I mean, all of that is impacting the environmental community, the environmental movement, if you will, or the green economy. So New York is absolutely part of that. That said, you know, we had a 10, 15 year head start. We started doing this as a state back in the late 2000s, and then really on an aggressive footing in the last 5 years. So are we going to meet our deadlines? Are we going to meet our targets? I think we absolutely have to. I don't think there's a possibility for us not. But there is a reality of this transition. All transitions are hard. Every single time you make change is very difficult. You have to listen to people, listen to stakeholders, advance policies that help to make those bridges between communities. And that's the position we're in right now. We're in that very delicate middle ground between you hatch a really good idea and you're implementing it. Now we're starting to implement it. And we're seeing the concerns pop up from lots of quarters that we're either not doing enough or we're doing too much. And all of that is real. All of those concerns we need to take into account. But ultimately, we have to do this because I think, listen, all of your listeners, many of your listeners are seeing the impacts of climate change in New York, seeing it worldwide. This is going to be the issue over the next 30 years that defines how we survive as a society. And I don't say that with a degree of hyperbole. I really truly believe that, or I wouldn't have gotten into this job. We have to find ways forward. School buses, right? There's myth and reality on the school buses. I mean, there's a lot of studies that go into electric school buses. There's one that came out, this purportedly came out of Vermont, that talked about their unreliability in cold weather. Well, you know, there's a study that came out in Montana that showed that these buses operate, electric school buses operate in subarctic conditions. So, I mean, the truth is out there. We have to plow through it and ultimately communicate. And the pushback from the legislature is, you know, we take that seriously and we communicate with them. We communicate with the communities, various community groups that have concerns. And I think that's just part of our job, is to communicate.
You were serving in your position as commissioner when PFAS contamination was confirmed in several New York communities, and that's now become a national issue. Is PFAS pollution.
It was my second week on the job.
Yeah. Do you think that there are lessons from the experiences of what the state went through when working through issues like Hoosick Falls that you applied to other things that happened along the way?
Yeah. Listen, I'm glad you raised that one. That was the second week of the job for me. somebody said, hey, it was a former deputy commissioner who said, hey, we've got this problem with something called PFAS in Hoosick Falls. And I didn't know what PFAS was or even where Hoosick Falls was, being brand new to the job. But I certainly learned quickly enough. You know, when you have a village lose its water supply, it's a very scary thing. And this is obviously right on the heels of Flint. It's on the heels of lots of things that were happening in the mid-2010s where people were beginning to, or truly beginning to mistrust institutions and governments. So I saw what was happening there as one of those pivot points for the agency and for the movement. People becoming aware of the conditions of their water, people at the same time perhaps lacking or losing faith in government, and then this 24/7 news cycle that all kind of hit at the same time, all that mixed up with this brand new technology, right? They can now measure to parts per trillion, which didn't really exist 20, 30 years ago, of course. So all of that sort of came together at the same point where, you know, when I took over at DEC, and we knew we had a serious crisis on our hands. And for me, I had to turn to everyone in the agency and say, team, how can we solve this? And the engineers had some solutions. Our communications team had some solutions. And then the forest rangers, you know, that we know from, you know, helicoptering or climbing into the Adirondacks and rescuing lives, said, hey, we can do plumbing installations and we can do it quickly and we can start to restore people's clean water. And they did. They organized what I said at the time, what I think was the fastest growing plumbing company in North America. That was just the ingenuity of people who knew how to deal with a crisis. So we had our rangers, our ECOs, our engineers. We opened a forward-facing office in the former Ford facility out there, Ford dealership, and just surged everyone in to solve the problem. And you know what? We did. I'm so proud of the 800 plumbing installations that we did. The work that we did, we obviously were taking it on the chin on a regular basis there, but we just determined to just keep working through it, work with the community, listen to the community, incorporate their concerns in, and ultimately determine how to kind of create these long-term solutions. So all of that came together. And that was like, for me, that was something that hasn't even finished yet. I still ask my staff on a regular basis, where are we with the alternate water supply? You know, where are we with the various cleanup, the Superfund negotiations? I mean, that's 8.5 years of work. So how do we apply that to everything else? It's, I think, just recognizing that we have to care about the smallest things. And that often is the water. You can't just think about big things like climate change and nation-leading policies. You have to worry about what's in the backyard, what's in your backyard, and be attuned to people when they tell you that they're afraid of what's in their water. And for us, that changed our agency. It really did. It put us from sort of a passive footing into something really proactive, very forward-leaning. We stopped using passive language, even in most of our press releases, as stupid as that sounds. I mean, I just wanted to get the agency thinking more proactively and to adopt more responsibility for everything that we did. And I think it's that approach we've taken into everything else that we've done as an agency. Not always perfect, but forward-leaning, use every resource that we have, work across with other agencies, and ultimately, you know, be present on the ground in communities and make these strong relationships.
When it comes to clean water, there's a discussion ongoing right now about a new method of fracking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Hydrofracking has had a moratorium and a ban mm-hmm. placed on it in New York.
Yeah.
And now there's a new method that involves gas,
mm-hmm.
CO2 gas. Is DEC examining the issue right now, this gas-based version of fracking? And do you have any thoughts on the matter?
Well, I tell you, I was asked this during my budget hearing a few weeks ago. We still have not received an application for this technology. I know about as much of it as you do, which is saying something. You know, they really have put an emphasis on outreach to communities down there without sort of engaging on the regulatory side, which always makes me concerned. By outreach, I'm saying that some of the leases, I think that I've heard the company is now inking down there. So, I mean, listen, I'm always concerned when the first approach is to apply by press release or apply by outreach to community. If you're going to apply for a permit, you really need to engage with the regulator. So we really are at this stage at a loss as to why that hasn't happened yet. And I'm skeptical as to this technology moving forward until I can, you know, actually take a look at it and see it and understand it, and potential impacts. You know, what this mean on a grand scale in the Southern Tier, for example? I mean, these are questions I can't even answer right now because I don't know what this actually is.
There's also ongoing discussion among particularly people in the Hudson Valley about PCB cleanup.
Yes.
And whether the EPA will require GE to go back to the river to do more cleanup. Mm-hmm. We saw it above the dam in Troy.
Yep.
But now there's the discussion as if that's needed in the lower Hudson. What do you think about this discussion? And are you hoping to see more PCB cleanup in the future?
Well, listen, we're going to let science drive us on this. Science has to drive this cleanup because there is a lot of concern and a lot of emotion involved with this incredibly significant Superfund site. Yes, a lot of work has been done. We're now nearing, I think, the next 5-year review cycle where the EPA is going to put out its determinations as to the progress of the cleanup, right? I'm going to hold judgment until we see that fully, what it looks like, what the science is saying about the cleanup. This is primarily the Upper Hudson. We had some concerns in the last cycle 5 years ago that the cleanup was not showing it was protective of human health and the environment, that ultimately the goals set out in the record of decision, the consent order, what triggered all of this work, were not going to be met, and the can was being kicked further down the road, right, by a factor of years and decades until the river would be fishable, right, fully fishable. So, yes, we are very concerned about it. There's no doubt there's still PCBs in the sediment. There's no doubt that it's likely traveled over the Troy Dam into the lower Hudson. You know, we are going to have to work closely with the EPA, as we always do, no matter the administration, to ensure that the numbers we're being shown are real. And if they're not, then we have to do our own science, which we've done in the past, I think, as you saw about 7 years ago.
You mentioned the Rangers with assisting in the Hoosick Falls water crisis. There's been stories that have been put out there about a shortage of Rangers and making sure that Rangers are trained, retained, and equipped.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about the future of New York State's Rangers and make sure that men and women stay on the job?
Listen, I feel really good about the Rangers right now. Hopefully the Rangers also feel good about the agency. Since my tenure, I think we've had four Ranger academies. The fifth one is going to start this spring. They're at their highest number ever, which is good. That said, obviously, there's more pressure than ever on the backcountry. There's more crises that we're having to respond to. I mean, talk about climate change, severe weather. Then our Rangers and ECOs are on the front lines of climate responses, right? Flooding, storm events, and the like. So, you know, we use them more and more for really big and important things. So I will always look to right-size the force, and I think that's why we're doing almost yearly, if not every 18 months, academies. That really was not the case for about a decade and a half at the agency, so we're catching up.
You're listening to WAMC. I'm Lucas Willard, speaking with New York State Department of Environmental Conservation Commissioner Basil Segos, who recently announced he intends to step down this spring after more than 8 years on the job. So the public usually sees you on the news, wearing a suit and tie behind a lectern. I remember seeing you one time on the job on the banks of a frozen Hudson River during kind of an informal tugboat roundup.
Yes, I remember that. Right.
Well, reflecting on that, the anniversary of that, I think, just came by. reflecting on that and the response to that, how do you think the agency responded? That was just a wild day.
That was a wild day. Yeah. I mean, it was an ice jam that broke, right? And not just a little bit of ice. It was the whole surface of the Hudson all of a sudden gave way. And, you know, every dock and, you know, every party boat and whatever structure was near the shoreline, it was getting washed away. And I think it was
Captain JP.
The Captain JP, yeah. Seeing that thing heading down towards the rail bridge. And I said to myself, all right, this is not good. We've got to start making some phone calls and corralling some resources. And that was actually, I mean, honestly, you know, no one got injured, thank God, on that one. It was dramatic as these massive ice chunks were floating past the waterfront in Albany and Troy. And, you know, we got quick response from a bunch of the tugboat captains who were able to get through the thick ice and start corralling some of these barges that were banging around. I mean, you know, I look back at it with a little bit of humor because it was you know, a bit of an insane event. But listen, this is DC. There are these events all the time. It's not always barges. You know, sometimes it's the bear up the tree. You know, we are so plugged into so many amazing, cool things that happen in the state and so many difficult things that happen in the state that, you know, that this job is one in which you get to, you know, have fun at times when you're solving problems.
Are you going to stay involved in New York State policies or politics moving forward?
Yeah, you know, look, I'm going to take a knee for a little bit. I think it's important to take time off once in a while. I haven't had more than a week off in 20 something years, so I think I'll start there. Am I going to remain involved in New York in politics? Absolutely. I mean, I truly love the state. I've really, really made it my home in every respect. Truly love public service. You know, that's going to be the toughest thing is just not being a public servant, because it is so rewarding. You know, it obviously there's costs to your family and sometimes to your health being in these jobs. But they truly are the greatest jobs when you're able to wake up every day and go in and serve people, make people's lives better. That's the goal every day. And you know, that the old adage of, you know, you never work a day in your life if you love what you do. I mean, that's just, it's corny, but it's so true. I mean, I've truly loved every single day and I never really felt like I was going to work. So public service, it'll always be, you know, there in my mind, you know, what the next chapter is. I'm still developing it, but I won't leave the space.
Do you have a favorite accomplishment and then also maybe a regret in your time as commissioner?
Yeah, a favorite accomplishment. I mean, you mentioned Hoosick Falls. That certainly is one of them. You know, the trial by fire and emerging from it ultimately, I think, successful. That, for me, is one. Climate Leadership Community Protection Act. I mean, getting that passed, of course. Running the Climate Action Council with Doreen Harris and NYSERDA. That was really, really important for me and how we've advanced that. Superfund reform, brownfields, I mean, $4.2 billion bond act, which we didn't have when I started, $5.5 billion of clean water, which didn't exist when I started. EPF was at zero, 136, what was it, 136, and now it's 400 million. I mean, so there's lots of things like that I can say, wow, I think I really accomplished something in this job. And then there's gonna be a lot of the little things that are just not seen that I really take pride in. Growing my staff from 2,800 to 3,300, right? It's not headline stuff, but it really makes a difference for New Yorkers' health and safety. First ever Deputy Commissioner for Equity and Justice, you know, I was really proud to start that. The first ever Indian Nations Affairs Office. Our FOIL response time, now 12 days. You know, it's little things like that ultimately that make a huge difference in the success of an agency or an institution when you mind the ship. You're not just chasing the big policies. You're focusing on your people. Again, taking out the passive language, right? Everything's active, forward-leaning, We have fun in the agency. I think I'm really proud of just setting a good tone at the agency and bringing in awesome people. And there's lots of the outside stuff that I'll never forget, you know, just driving through the Adirondacks. And, well, there's the, you know, Finch property, right? Had a hand in doing that. The Follinsbee property that we just announced a couple weeks ago. That to me is going to be some legacy stuff. But yeah, it's the people that you work with that you treasure the most, I think, and that's what I will miss the most.
And any regrets or anything you didn't
get? Regrets? Come,
yeah.
Yeah, I don't think I've changed ultimately. I would have liked more time to continue diversifying the agency. You know, we are still a very homogenous agency, and I know a lot of conservation agencies suffer from that, but we've started to put into place those policies and those practices that will make us more representative of New Yorkers. And I think that, to me, is one thing where I wouldn't call it as much of a regret as much as I would, this is something I really have not yet accomplished that I really wanted to. Of course, there's probably lots of regrets, things I shouldn't have said in public, or, you know, places I should have been when I wasn't. Those are lots of little things, honestly. And you tend not to think about those. At least I tend not to think about them. Maybe that's why I'm still in this job. I try not to obsess about criticism as much as I am as hard on myself. I don't really get into the criticism. I don't read a lot of the comments on social media. I try to keep a positive outlook on everything I do. And I never take swipes at people. It's just not my style. People are swiping me, it's for some reason that I've got to kind of understand, and yet just plow forward and be positive, try to be a leader as well as a manager.
And Ukraine, the war is still going on, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And you've volunteered in the past. Are you planning on any other trips to Ukraine?
Is my wife listening? I'm not sure. Listen, that's been one of the most rewarding things of my life. Being a part of this small sliver of humanitarian help in the middle of that war. You know, I think that it is one of those issues right now that is so consequential to everything that we care about here, even here in Albany, right? We work on climate change, you work on elections, you know, making sure that our democracy is sound. So much of it traces back to what's going on over there. And I say that because there's really, in a way, there's a pivot point between two very different futures with Ukraine out right now. So one where Ukraine gets rolled over, right? We allow it to happen. Western societies, we, and the U.S., we allow it to happen. Ukraine falls. Russia moves toward NATO, or Russia takes over non-NATO countries and continues this. And China looks at Taiwan, and other authoritarian nations look at other places they might want to take over and steamroll. Is that the future that we want? Or is it one in which we defend democracy? You know, we defend democracy at home and abroad. We look out for the rights of the underdog. We champion our international institutions that we've built, NATO, the UN, right? We built those things for a reason. Yes, they're not perfect. You know, the UN, of course, hasn't yet reached its mission of preventing wars. That doesn't mean we give up on them. It means maybe they need some reform. So I think we have some choices to make right now that are really consequential. You think about like climate change, for example. You know, we can't do this just alone here in New York. It's got to be national, but it's got to be international. What happens if that we don't have a platform for working together on an international level because we've lost so much by Ukraine's failing, by Ukraine's collapse? That to me is frightening because we need to ultimately have that international cohesion. But it does boil down to people again. Like, you know, I was moved by what was going on at the early stages of the war. I determined I needed to get off the sidelines, do what I could to help. So again, small sliver of help, right? Just delivering primarily ambulances and medical supplies. But in the process, getting over there, you know, seeing the damage firsthand, meeting the people firsthand, befriending many of them, eating with some of the soldiers in trenches and bringing some degree of hope or help, you know, that the wider world cared about what they were going for. For me, I mean, there's some just things that just will never get out of my mind. All of it positive, yes, in the context of some true horror, But you see something like that, and you see how people persevere through trauma. There's laughter in trenches, you know, laughter in villages that have been destroyed, where people have been recently killed, and yet there's still kind of positivity, like people finding a way forward. So it's been, in that respect, very inspiring for me to see that and experience it firsthand. So I'm going to remain involved, absolutely. I'll get back there if I can. That's my intent. I've been there 3 times. I've been able to, you know, I've gone out. Last time I was there, we went from delivering an ambulance to the front line, and then a couple of days later, we were in the president's office in the Situation Room, talking about battlefield medicine. So there's just the swings of emotion and experience have been something that honestly have changed my life and ultimately I think made me interested in helping out on a bigger scale.
Last question: with looking ahead at DEC at New York, when you're no longer commissioner, a lot of environmental policy that comes out of New York ends up being mimicked across the country.
Yeah.
So, you know, what are your hopes and predictions for how New York will continue and how Governor Hochul will continue?
I am 100% confident that this governor will continue to lead not just New York, but the country on the environment. I mean, she truly gets it. Her second day on the job, she had a meeting with EPA Administrator Michael Regan and me to talk about climate work on water. That was her second day. I think within her a couple of weeks, it was some hurricane and some massive damage downstate. So I think she has experienced these issues personally, environmental issues, her whole life. She tells a story about, you know, Lake Erie pollution. And then, you know, it hit home hard when she took office. She's been done nothing but give us incredible resources at the agency. Again, in a year where there's tightness in the budget, you know, our staffing is going to be held steady, and we're actually getting more money for a range of issues. So, you know, I'm confident that under her leadership, this state will continue to be a leader, continue to lead the way in the country. You know, California gets lots of credit all the time. I not that I have a chip on my shoulder about California, but I think that most things happen in New York. Sun rises first here. We do the really tough stuff here and ultimately set the tone for the nation.
Okay, that does it for this episode of the WAMC News Podcast. Thanks so much for listening, and thanks to my colleague Lucas Willard for that interview. Until next time, I'm Ian Pickus.